KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. We're entering the third full day of firestorms raging across Northern California. At least 17 people are reported dead due to the blazes, which have burned over 162,000 acres and forced thousands of evacuations. In this hour, we're going to get an update on the fires, and we're also going to talk to a panel of experts about disaster preparedness and tools for communication during an emergency. And we'd like to hear from you. What questions do you have about preparing for a disaster? It's all coming up next after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. It's the third day of fires raging across Northern California, and at least 17 people are reported dead due to the fires. And there are now 21 fires in Northern California, and they have burned about 162,000 acres and thousands of homes and structures. For this hour, we're going to talk about what preparing you can do for disasters and what communication tools are available during an emergency. But first, some clues are emerging about possible causes of the fires. I spoke just a few moments ago with Paul Rogers, managing editor of KQED's Science Unit and reporter for the Mercury News. I asked him about his story looking at the possible role of PG&E power lines damaged in the high winds.
We reviewed the dispatch records from Sonoma County and basically looked at what happened on Sunday night. And the first report in the Santa Rosa area of fires was at 9:22 p.m. Sunday night. And over the next 90 minutes, emergency crews were sent to at least 10 different locations near and around the city to respond to reports of arcing power lines, downed power lines, and exploding transformers.
And maintenance figures in this, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You know, when you look at a system like PG&E's, you've basically got tens of thousands of miles of electrical wires. And state law requires that utilities cut back trees from their power lines, that they keep a safe distance. You know, this is something that has caused many other fires over the years around the state. And we don't know for sure that this is the cause. But certainly when you look at, 10 fires or more that all started around the same time in the middle of the night, there are really only a few logical explanations. One would be arson. One would be lightning, which a lot of the fire experts are ruling out now. And one would be the fact that the winds in that area were more than 50 miles an hour. And when winds blow hard, you've got trees that can come down and hit power lines. You've got lines that can blow down, lines that can blow into each other and arc. And that's a pretty common way to start fires.
There is a history, isn't there, of wildfires due to inadequate maintenance?
Yes, indeed. PG&E is already in trouble for a fire 2 years ago called the Butte Fire up in Amador County. One of their power lines was not properly maintained. It was blamed by investigators for a fire that burned 70,000 acres, burned down about 500 homes, killed two people. They were fined $8.3 million by the PUC. There was a huge series of fires people might remember in 2007 in San Diego. It was found that San Diego Gas and Electric had power line problems that caused that. They are facing hundreds of millions of dollars in claims and lawsuits. These things are very expensive. And, as I say, the fire crews are still investigating the causes of these fires. But if PG&E, if their equipment is found to be at fault, there is going to be a process that's going to go over many months and years.
Goes to the PUC?
Yes, sir. And it's probably going to be similar to the San Bruno gas line explosions. We're talking major investigations, hundreds of millions of dollars of potential liability.
Speaking of San Bruno, we had State Senator Jerry Hill speaking out about this and saying if there's culpability here with PG&E, we're going to have to really essentially turn it into a public utility.
Yeah, he has been, following the San Bruno thing, obviously, since that's his area for the last 7 or 8 years. And he told me yesterday that this would be the last straw for him. Now, we don't want to put the cart ahead of the horse here. There's still a lot to be investigated. And certainly, I'm going to expect that fire crews and fire investigators are looking at this as one of the main potential causes. If it's found out that PG&E lines did cause this problem, what we're going to end up seeing is PG&E arguing that it was an act of God, that the winds were too strong. And then we'll have to see what were the standards, how strong should lines be, what kind of winds should they be able to withstand.
They're already suggesting some of that. I mean, didn't they respond? You talked to Matt Nauman of PG&E, and he said this is all speculative.
Well, he said it was speculative, but they also said, and I'll read the statement, quote, these destructive winds, along with millions of trees weakened by years of drought and recent renewed vegetation growth from winter storms, all contributed to some trees, branches, and debris impacting our electric lines across the North Bay. In some cases, and this is PG&E's statement, we have found instances of wires down, broken poles, and impacted infrastructure. Where those have occurred, we have reported them to the PUC and Cal Fire.
Paul, let me ask you, because listeners have brought this up and it sort of buzzed around in my head, why aren't wires underground? They are in other countries.
That's a good question. Again, we have more than 100,000 miles of power lines in California, from the big transmission lines to the small distribution lines. To put them underground is incredibly expensive, especially in earthquake country. You have to build concrete vaults underground that can withstand the movement of ground. Remember what happened in San Bruno. When the ground changes, you can get problems and cracks and things. So it's really expensive. It's been done in a few places, but I just don't see it as feasible for the whole state.
Paul, again, thank you so much for your great reporting.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Again, that was Paul Rogers. I spoke with him earlier this morning, managing editor at KQED's Science Unit and environment writer for the Mercury News. And we've been hearing a lot of the situation in Napa and Sonoma counties, not so much about Mendocino. 29,500 acres have burned up there in the Redwood Fire, which is 5% contained. And for an update from Mendocino, we now turn to Sarah Wright. She's a reporter with KZYZ in Mendocino. And welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, too. Thanks.
I guess let's talk about fatalities there and communication problems up in Willits. There's no cell or internet and so forth, so things have been pretty incommunicado.
Well, I just heard that really early in the morning, cell service was restored to Willits. But yesterday, I think the scene was best epitomized by the crowds of people gathered at the VU library just trying to get one tiny half a bar on their cell phones or just a minute or two of bandwidth so they could let their families know what was going on, because there were people even out of the country who knew more about what was going on in Mendocino than people right up there in Willits, just about a half hour north of Redwood Valley, which was pretty badly devastated.
Do we know the acreage yet that's burned up there?
It keeps increasing. You said 29,500, and that's what I saw this morning at about 7 o'clock. Last night, it was at about 26,000, but the perimeter keeps shifting. And Cal Fire is telling us that it is difficult for them to see where the active burns are because the smoke is so thick that they're just dumping record numbers of water and retardant and hoping that they hit the flames. And as soon as it either burns itself out or gets doused on one perimeter, it springs up on another. So it's spreading to the east and to the north, and we've got high winds expected today, north-northwest winds, 8 to 14 miles per hour, which is, you know, definitely not 50 miles per hour, but it's not good news for firefighters.
It's scary, and I know there have been 3 casualties so far that you know of?
That's what's been confirmed, but it is pretty unsafe to head into Redwood Valley. Some folks, as always, did not want to evacuate, and to follow up on your previous guest, there are a lot of downed power lines and trees, and our sheriff told us that there were eyewitness accounts of trees falling on power lines in Powder Valley, although this fire was started by 2 different fires in Redwood Valley and Powder Valley. So, of course, we don't know for sure yet what started them, but arson is not a suspected factor.
Do you have any idea why Mendocino is getting less attention than other areas? Because it is.
Yeah, it definitely is. You know, Sonoma is such a hub of wine country, and it's pretty urban. It's part of the Bay Area. I don't know. I've heard some frustration from folks up in Willits since they're mostly safe. There's this Pine Mountain area that's evacuated, but a lot of folks in Willits are just kind of waiting around for news and feeling really anxious and deprived and kind of unhappy about it.
Well, we wish you the best of luck, and certainly our hearts go out to the suffering that's going on up there, and I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much.
That's Sarah Wright. She's a reporter with KZYZ, and she's been covering the fires in Mendocino County. She joined us from Ukiah. And certainly, compassion and concern are very much prevalent now, but we do want to find out what can be done in the way of preparedness. And we have a number of people with us to talk about that. Kevin Van Leer is here in studio. He's a wildfire product manager with RMS, a risk management company. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Also good to have Barry Pilger, who joins us this morning by phone. He lost his home back in the Oakland Fire almost 26 years ago and is now chair of the North Hills Community Association. And that loss, Barry, kind of shaped your destiny in many ways in terms of really wanting to inform people and doing it now to a great extent, yes?
Yes, it did. Thank you for having me, Michael. I didn't really become politically active until about 10 years after the fire, and have essentially been nose to the grindstone and advocating with City Hall and other government agencies on all sorts of fronts involving prevention. So there we are.
Well, let's talk about prevention with you, and let's begin just by getting a picture of what people can do. I mean, you lost your home 26 years ago. You learned a great deal about preparedness from that terrible episode in your life. And there are, first of all, really things that can be done, but the primary thing is to get out when you can, because I think your story is you might have stayed around if you weren't away from your home, and you might have actually been lost. Your life's lost in the fire.
No question. We were the youngest and most able people on the street. I was a working general contractor at the time, and we would have stayed behind. There's no question. We did have a couple of neighbors who did exactly that and perished. But what to do? And just a little bit of context here. We'd been living on Buckingham Boulevard for 14 years at the time of the fire, and when we built our house in 1977, we noticed that there were charred stumps on the lot, and we thought, oh, well, yeah, that fire was in 1970. There were, I don't know, 15 or 20 homes at the intersection of Norfolk and Buckingham that burned in 1970. Well, this was 7 years later. We were young, and we said, let's just go ahead. It was a novelty to have charred stumps on the lot. And lo and behold, 14 years later, more than charred stumps, but, a lost home. And suddenly you take those things seriously. What to do? Well, there are tremendous resources for homeowners to look up. CAL FIRE has a great website where you can read about the fire code within the wildland urban interface area and defensible space. And I'm not going to spend any time talking about that at all now because the resources are there. What you've got to do is you've got to do it. Secondly, municipalities need to step up and make sure that the codes are enforced. It's been particularly challenging for us in Oakland to get the vegetation management unit of the fire department properly staffed and properly managed, and we're on that now. We finally got all the money in the budget for that, for the municipal support, but they can't seem to fill their positions and keep it staffed. So there are many things to be done on many fronts.
Well, in fact, one of the things I believe you've called attention to are family service radios and a plan particularly where loved ones are concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. We, like within months after the fire, made sure that we were equipped with FRS radios. For your listeners, just go to any search engine and type in FRS radios. They're available anywhere. They're little handheld walkie-talkies. We have one in each vehicle. We have two here at home. There's a monthly test in our neighborhood of the system. We've got a few neighbors who tune in on the first Thursday of every month and test the radios. They have a line of sight communications capability of several miles, and my wife Catherine and I have done a rehearsal. In fact, we just tested them a couple weeks ago, where if we get separated, one of us goes left, one of us goes right, perhaps one of us is at our downtown office and one of us is at home. Every hour on the hour, one of us goes to a promontory, a high hill, a deck, or somewhere where you've got good line of sight all over the Bay Area. And for 3 minutes, we try and find one another on the FRS radios. And we've worked that out, and luckily we've never had to use it. But we do test it occasionally, and it works very well. They're very inexpensive.
That's Barry Pilger. He is chief now of the North Hills Community Association, lost his home back in the Oakland fires almost 26 years ago. Kevin Van Leer here in studio with us is wildfire product manager with RMS, a risk management company. And let's talk about, there's kind of a top 10 list, really, I think, Kevin, that maybe you can just let listeners be aware of what you can do to reduce wildfire risks.
Yeah, absolutely. My company is really focused on reducing property risk or providing an understanding of what really differentiates one building from another when thinking about not only wildfires, but earthquakes, hurricanes, et cetera.
But generally, people are least prepared for wildfires. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So when you think about wildfire and this top 10 list that I was looking at just yesterday when thinking about preparedness for my own home is...
Can I just reiterate one thing? Get out quickly again, I think, needs to be...
Yeah, absolutely. Get out quickly. And I think from the property perspective, it's the things that Barry was mentioning, things like defensible space or... the building materials that were used around your home, whether that's fences or decks, being able to lift the wall siding, the siding of your building beyond 6 inches above the ground, so to really reduce that risk of the actual property. But as you mentioned, when thinking about evacuation, it is get out. When there's a mandatory evacuation, get out. Have the preparedness, a plan in place with your family members, really echoing a lot of the comments that Barry made.
Can you also say something about, you know, things like a fireproof safe or, you know, a go bag or just a disaster kit that you're ready to take and get out quickly with?
Absolutely. Those are two great things. So one is being, you mentioned the fireproof safe. So being able to have your important documents, if you're not able to carry them with you, say copies of them in something like a go bag, have them in a fireproof safe within your home. The thing about the go bag, though, is you can have copies of that in addition to things like a small first aid kit, any sort of prescriptions, being able to have those available to you, your important documents, like maybe your insurance policy. A lot of my role is understanding the impacts to insurance. So having your insurance policy, understanding what it covers. Also, when you leave, being able to save potentially those receipts for things like hotels or food, because a lot of times when in an evacuation, that would potentially be covered under your policy. So having a go bag, having those documents, having the resources you need, whether that's first aid, water, food, all those pieces are really important when you need to get out quickly.
And speaking of documents, Barry Pilger, I know you went to the trouble of photographing a lot of things in your house, and it made it a lot easier. We're going to talk with an insurance expert, but it made it a lot easier when you had to make claims, yes?
Well, I wish I could claim credit for having thought of doing that. We had planned a remodel of our house within a year before the fire, and our architect had taken, you remember rolls of film when we used to have rolls? He took two rolls of film of every angle inside and outside the house, and of course he did takeoff plans of the house as is, and plus the room addition that we were planning. So we had everything that we would need to prepare the insurance claim, and you know, I, as I mentioned, I was a working general contractor at the time, so I knew how to put the documents together. We put together a scrapbook. We had all the photographs. We settled within 3 weeks with our insurance company for within a couple $1,000s of our claim. So we were lucky. Now people can do that now, certainly. If all you do is walk through every room with your smartphone and phone and do a video, and make sure that video is stored somewhere else other than inside your house, then you will have accomplished the same thing. It's a very, very important thing. And yes, we do have a fireproof safe, and yes, we do have videos stored offsite of everything that we own and inventories and that sort of thing. It's everything Kevin said is absolutely bang on.
Yeah, and speaking of using your smartphone, I know during the disaster in Oakland, you were glued to KQED and KCBS. I wanted to mention that, but you know, a lot of people can't get any reception. They don't have cells, particularly now with what's going on up north. Recommendations, Kevin Van Leer?
Yeah, sure. I think one important part of this is having a plan, because as we're seeing up in the cell service up in the fires in Northern California, is cell service can be spotty if existent at all. So important part to plan with your family is maybe have a contact outside the community. I know that my wife and I, we have contacts in other parts of the country where maybe if there's a disaster here in the Bay Area, whether it's a fire or an earthquake, being able to contact someone outside the area, because maybe we wouldn't have cell service at the same time. It could be spotty. Maybe we're separated. So being able to contact, make sure that we can contact somebody outside the area to make sure we know that we're safe. So,
you know, there's been difficulties with evacuation maps. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to point out that there are local resources. I mean, CAL FIRE provides them and so forth that people can go to in this kind of disaster.
Right. I was just checking this morning. I know there was some new evacuations up in the area, potentially around Calistoga. But the local resources that you'll have are the counties. So Sonoma County, Napa County, their websites, their official Twitter pages, all those resources, being able to get the latest information directly from the source, in addition to CAL FIRE, being able to know not only what communities are being evacuated, but what direction to go. That's a really important part with wildfire.
Again, Kevin Van Leer is wildfire product manager for RMS. They're a risk management company, and we're talking about the firestorms in Northern California and disaster preparedness. We have a link to tips for preparing your go bag up at our website, kqed.org/forum, and we want to bring Lisa and St. Dennis with into this conversation. And Lisa St. Anne Dennis is a research scientist at the University of Colorado Boulder. She studies how social media volunteer teams can work with emergency responders to disseminate information to the public and the press. And welcome to the program, Lisa St. Anne Dennis.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And want to find out from you, first of all, what role social media should play and do play in a disaster such as the one we've just been witnessing and are continuing to witness, alas. I know, for example, there's a program up at the sheriff's office near you that really is almost a national example of it working well. Tell us about it.
Sure. So I think it's really important to consider social media as a really critical channel of communication in disaster. There's a large portion of the population that relies on that for their information. And I think that it can be a really effective way to get information to the public. I do research within the virtual operational support team community. And one of the teams I have worked with is based out of Jefferson County, Colorado. And they developed what they call their integrated social media plan. And there are a couple of really important pieces to that. So I think what's interesting to me is how they're able to take different social media channels and make them work together effectively, both for providing content to the public and also to social media, their audience on social media.
There's a lot there. I mean, there's blogs and Twitter. You've actually embedded public information officers as well as cameramen in these Twitters and so forth. But what about the fact that maybe some would say we're overusing social media, especially when communities lose connectivity, such as is happening up north here in these fires?
I think it's important not to rely on one particular communication channel in disaster. I think that the responders that I work with see social media as an important extension to their communications. But I think one thing we've all learned in disaster is that communication channels are volatile and may or may not be up at a particular point in time. And so I think it's important to have those channels as part of your arsenal, as part of your communication plan, but not to rely on them exclusively.
Again, Lisa Ann St. Dennis is a research scientist, University of Colorado, who studies social media, volunteer teams, and works with emergency responders. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your being with us.
Sure, thank you.
And now I want to invite you, our listeners. I know many of you have questions about preparedness and how to communicate during disasters of this sort. Let me give you the phone number, and you can join us right now. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us now by calling 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll continue and hear from you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the firestorms in Northern California and disaster preparedness in this hour, how best to prepare for a disaster, how to communicate during one, and we do want to hear from you. Barry Pilger's with us from North Hills Community Association, and Kevin Van Leer here in studio from RMS, a risk managing company, and Ted Goldberg has joined us from KQED News, who actually is going to report to us on the briefing that went on in the Napa County Sheriff's Office. Welcome to the program, Ted.
Thank you, Michael.
So what did you find out?
So a few data points that came out during the news conference. The first is, as we've been reporting throughout the morning, they're expecting wind gusts to increase this afternoon and to actually change direction to go from the north to the south. The fire chief for the Napa County Fire Department described behavior this afternoon as possibly extreme fire behavior. So expect some changes to take place this afternoon. Another item that came out from the news conference County officials there had said had gotten a lot of questions. How many people were forced from their homes? How many people, were evacuees? Right now, they don't have a count on how many people are out of their homes because they're really focused on life-saving issues, and there's just so many people right now. One other data point that came out, we reported this morning that there were portions of the city of Calistoga that were under mandatory evacuation orders. The mayor of Calistoga said that half of the city left early this morning between 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning.
With all the emphasis on evacuations and saving lives, it's really been hard to get the numbers, the hard numbers, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. The county officials said that they just have not been able to tabulate that kind of information, that their focus really is on trying to get people out. Later on, they'll be able to provide some data they'll need to, but they just don't have those numbers quite
yet. In fact, the mayor of Santa Rosa has on a number of occasions that we need that data, and I suppose people are anxious to hear what they can, but it's been very difficult, as we've said, with the evacuations and with the difficulties in terms of trying to save lives. Ted, thanks so much for that report. Appreciate hearing from you.
Thank you.
Ted Goldberg of KQED News. And we're going to go right to your calls and emails. And I remind you, if you have questions for our guest, Barry Pilger from the North Hills Community Association, or Kevin Van Leer, who is with RMS, they're a risk management company, feel free to join us. You can do that by phone, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. And also going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Has your home or business been affected by the fires? You can also, of course, and we invite you to do this, share your experiences with us. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Virginia is our first caller. In Virginia, we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. I had my house burn in the Oakland fire many years ago, and I had relied upon the safety of a fireproof safe. It was rated to 1,800 degrees, and when I went back, I found the ceramic pads and the safe had completely disintegrated and melted, and all the documents inside had burned. So it is not safe unless your fireproof safe is rated at something like 2,500 degrees to leave anything in a fireproof safe. I would not encourage people to do that. I would encourage people to post things to the cloud or get a safe deposit box if things are really important and special.
Yeah, that's an important point, and I thank you for it. Do you want to comment on that, Kevin Van Leer?
Yeah, sure. I think it's going back to the point of having copies of those documents, those really important ones within your go bag or however you're when you evacuate, having those documents and copies of them with you, or as the caller mentioned, in the cloud or some place that you can access them outside of your home.
And we'll access some more calls. Let me go next to a caller from Woodside. Brian, that's you. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. I just want to say, my friend lost basically her whole neighborhood and Santa Rosa. And it's just kind of ridiculous to me that, her life was dependent on her neighbor waking her up, and that, California doesn't have, tornadoes, sirens, in the rest of the country, whereas, that gives people at least, 5-10 minutes to wake up, find out what's going on, and figure out how to get out of there. I mean, in this situation, if people went down the wrong road, they could be dead. I mean, it's just astonishing to me that this has not been thought out better,
What about, and I thank you for that call, Brian, what about sirens of some sort? Barry Pilger, have some thoughts? Want to reflect on that?
Well, the East Bay has a siren system.
Yeah.
In fact, I can actually hear two from my house, and I'm way up in the remote in North Oakland Hills. I actually can see one up on Grizzly Peak, and then there's one down at the bottom of Tunnel Road. They're tested, I believe it's at noon on the first Wednesday of every month. They were not operational for several years, and we started asking questions about them and were sort of put off. And then finally, they said, it's going to be a couple of years before they get them back up and running. But they were literally back up and running about 4 months ago, and now they're tested monthly. I believe the siren system in the East Bay goes from Richmond to San Leandro, something like that. You can find it online, but we're protected. I think a statewide system would be pretty nifty as well, but in the East Bay, we're covered.
And let me thank Brian for the call. We spoke a moment ago, Kevin Van Leer, about the fact that the CAL FIRE website is not necessarily providing. There are other local resources. I wonder what you can say to a listener by the name of Nancy, who writes the following. We live on the east side of the city of Sonoma. We were evacuated previously, but are back in our home now. We are extremely frustrated by the lack of information about wildfires near us. The CAL FIRE website is sorely deficient. We are trying other sources, but are not having very much luck about up-to-date information. Where do we go for this? We know that there are fires just a few miles from us, but we don't know whether the fire is headed our way.
Yeah, it's a really difficult problem that I've seen some reports of. So I know at least with Sonoma County, I checked the website just before I walked in here today.
We had some complaints about that website just yesterday.
Yeah, I think that there is at least some current evacuation information on there. Having access to sometimes social media can be useful. There is a lot of other information out there. So it's a really difficult problem that I've seen. I think it's reflective of the fact that there's a lot of fires ongoing, a lot of different changing wind directions like we'll see today. It's definitely a problem I've seen a lot of. Keeping track of the Twitter, the official sources of information like the counties would be the best bet for as far as I know.
Let me go to more calls. Julie joins us next. Julie, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. My question is because I'm insulin-dependent diabetic, and besides all my pills, I have to take insulin. That means having a meter and all the various supplies. Are these things I should have with me on my person everywhere I go?
Thoughts on that, Kevin? Barry, who wants to spit up a bit?
Absolutely.
Barry Pilger,
by all means.
Yeah, he's saying absolutely. And brings up other questions, though. Maybe we can address them. I mean, about disabled people in terms of a disaster of this sort and what kind of precautions can be taken, what the best precautions are. And, of course, a lot of people are worried about their pets, too. Some thoughts from you, Kevin Van Lee?
Yeah, I think just going back to the last caller and the last question of medicine, I saw on the FEMA website or the Red Cross website having at least a 7-day supply of your medication in that go bag or available to you so you can leave quickly. The pets are definitely an important issue. Make sure you have a plan for your pet or a go bag for your pet. So when you need to leave early, that you have food, you have maybe their medication along with them. It's definitely an important problem to make sure you are prepared and can leave quickly with those types of supplies.
And there are CERT programs that train you for disaster preparedness. I think in just major communities and metropolises throughout the Bay Area. Let's talk a moment, though, before we go to more calls here, Barry Pilger, about the aftermath. We've been talking about preparedness, but one of the preparedness notions really that ought to be taken under advisement is just the physical and emotional and financial tolls that these losses and pain. You never can really be prepared for all that, but in some ways you certainly have to be at least somewhat conscious that it's going to hit big when it does hit.
Absolutely. That starts a number of places, but I would counsel anyone who finds themselves worried about the potential disaster, whether it's an earthquake or a fire, to start with understanding the insurance policy. We got a very quick master's degree in insurance, understanding things like the personal property portion of your insurance policy is a percentage of the face value of the coverage for the house, and then there's a category called appurtenant structures, and then there's temporary living allowances, and then there's guaranteed replacement. One should be somewhat familiar with that terminology and not have to rudely confront it in the face of, oh my God, I'm going to have to file a claim. It's a really good place to start. Pull out the policy, read through it, consult with your agent and say, is coverage enough? And update that annually. I've got a head start on this. I'm a general contractor, and I know pretty much what it would cost to replace our house. And my insurance broker I've been with for 30 years knows as well. So that's a very good thing. Secondly, don't discount the fact that your friends are going to be and your family are going to be absolutely critical. Back to a point Kevin made and your other guest about social media. Back in 1991, we had the old-fashioned version of social media. Kevin mentioned having a friend outside the area. Well, Catherine's parents were alive at the time, and they were living in Panola, and they were our contact outside the area. They had been very social with many of our friends, and so all of our friends, knowing that they couldn't reach us, called Beverly and Wally in Panola. And literally, Beverly was our lifeline to all of our friends until we've managed to get resituated and have our own phone number again. And that worked out just great. And to the extent that that they were plugged into the radio or the television or heard news or got phone calls from our friends with information we needed to know, then that was relayed to us through them. So you don't need to be on Twitter. You don't need to be on Facebook. You don't need to be plugged into those social media feeds if you've got someone like that who perhaps is or perhaps isn't, and that can be absolutely central. Plus, there's that element of family and friendship, of support, of emotional support. We had offers from six friends to come live with them, and that sort of social network, the real social network, was invaluable in terms of our recovery.
And let me say something about that, because I have been struck and have said on a number of occasions, just a real beacon of hope, but the way people have been selflessly reaching out to those in need and those who have been displaced and have gone through losses here, there's been tremendous courage and resilience and heroic actions that really need to be singled out. We're also getting some really fine suggestions about communication here. Let me just read a couple of them. Noel says, sounds like it'd be a good idea to keep landline phones. And Martin writes, besides the Zello Android app that turns your tablet or phone into a walkie-talkie, you can get a 2-meter ham walkie-talkie for $50 or less. It's easy to get a technician license. You don't need to learn code. I live in Santa Rosa, and being a ham has been very, very useful throughout this. Let me bring more callers on here, and let's go next to Oakland. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. What is the responsibility of a property owner to their renters before, during, and after a disaster? And how might an ethical owner of a multifamily property prepare for their tenants?
Kevin, Barry, who wants to step up here?
I've never confronted that question.
Well, you know what? It's a good question. Yeah. But you know what, Aaron? I think it's a little perhaps beyond the expertise of our guests. If somebody has an answer to Aaron's question, please send it in. You can tweet it to us. You can send it to us by email, or you can communicate with us by phone. But I hope we can get that answered for you, Aaron, and thank you for that. Let me go to
Michael. Let me take a stab at it. I'm a real estate broker.
All right, go ahead.
I manage rental property. Most rental agreements are going to have a clause in them that deals with the loss of the property. And effectively, as I recall, in the standard California Association of Realtors rental agreement, basically, if there's no dwelling, the renter's rights are extinguished. Now, in jurisdictions that have rent control, like Berkeley and San Francisco, and to a slightly lesser extent in Oakland, there could very well be a long term, if the property is rebuilt, the tenant has a right to reclaim the tenancy, but that's going to be unique by jurisdiction and subject to municipal ordinance. So I think every case is going to be a little bit different, but generally speaking, I would imagine the tenancy rights would be extended.
And Kevin, you wanted to add something here? Kevin?
Yeah, I think this could be an opportunity with the disasters that we're seeing in the North Bay, an opportunity to actually ask those questions of your property owner to really start that conversation if you don't know.
Another strong suggestion from a listener named Leah. She says, neighborhood networks are essential. Get to know your neighbors, as you will rely on each other in the initial aftermath of any unexpected event. First responders will be overwhelmed. Would a predetermined hashtag for social media use within a zone or neighborhood be a good idea? Probably would be, indeed. Let me bring some more of our callers on here. And Marcus, we go to you next. Marcus, welcome.
Sure. Yeah, I live in Kenwood with my family, and we were evacuated on Sunday night. A neighbor came to our house and told us to get out. We get out, and we're looking at flames everywhere and the mountains about a half a mile from our house. But one thing I wanted to speak to is just the lack of specific information that's coming out of these areas. And the news has a tendency to find destruction and, report from that place of destruction. But there isn't information specifically on the communities, and so people are chomping at the bit to try to get back and figure out what's going on with their properties. And in many cases,
they just can't do that, as I'm sure you're well aware, Marcus. They can't get
there. Yeah. Well, I'll be honest. Yesterday, I drove in and had to drive through the mountains to get back to Kenwood, sort of evading roadblocks to get to my property. And there were lots of people doing just that. And had there been better information, three days out of what's specifically going on, I don't think that people would be doing that. And, it was just surprising how little information, even today, where there are areas where people could easily go in and see what's happening, there's still no information coming out of those areas. And so a lot of people are, it's their entire lives that they're trying to figure out what's going on with.
Yeah, I appreciate your weighing in on that. As we've been hearing, there's been a lot of complaints about lack of information, but it needs to be reiterated that evacuations and life-saving are a priority and continue to be a priority. But still, there are ways to get information out, and we're hearing about some of those. Let me bring another caller in here, and that's Oliver. Oliver, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to add a brief comment about go bags. It's important that you keep the go bag itself secure. We were burglarized in May, and certainly anything of value that would have been stored in the bag would very likely have been taken.
Good idea, and thank you for that. I really appreciate all these suggestions that are coming in from listeners through emails and posting on our website and calls. But let me go to a comment here, actually on our website, and get a response from you, Kevin Van Leer. Liz writes, my in-laws got out of their house within seconds of being burnt to a crisp. I'm so frustrated. There were no calls made to them. What's the responsibility of CAL FIRE or the local firefighters? I mean, who's responsible for evacuations ultimately?
It's a difficult question, maybe a little bit beyond my understanding, but what I've seen is there is going the resources on the ground as far as the local firefighters are going door to door. So they are trying to get people out when there is a mandatory evacuation. As we've mentioned before, this is a pretty chaotic situation right now with a lot of fires ongoing. The wind direction's changing. So it is a difficult situation, but I know there is some efforts when those evacuations are taking place where they're going door to door to try and get people out. But.
Well, there's a good suggestion here again in the way of communication from Rick, who says, please remind listeners to text their zip codes to 888-777 to get text alerts about evacuations and other emergencies.
Yeah, I, as a meteorologist growing up in the Midwest, we're familiar with tornadoes and things like that where there is sirens. There are other forms of communication to get those alerts, and maybe text alerts are a good idea for a lot of people.
And let me go to more of your calls. And again, if you'd like to join us, if you have questions or if you have comments, we welcome your involvement in the program. The toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us forum@kqed.org. Here's Nancy. Nancy, welcome.
In researching some preparations, I found information about fire safes indicating that it's important to put your documents inside Ziploc bags, the same with safety deposit boxes, that if the fire is actually put out with water, then your documents will have been saved from the fire but damaged by the water. And one other thing, we received a request from friends near fires in Santa Rosa to ship respiratory fine particulate face masks from Amazon to addresses there because there are no more masks in stores anywhere. And that was a very specific request and a way to help if there is a way to find an address to ship to.
Also useful information, Nancy. Thank you. Appreciate hearing from you. And again, we get so much from our listeners here of value. Let me get Don on next. Don, thanks for waiting. You're on.
I'm sorry. Did you say Don?
I did.
Yes. Oh, thank you. I just wanted to follow up on the point that a couple of other callers made, and the way I would express it is the most important piece of information that people need is a map of where the fire is and where the front is and what direction it's moving. And I'm surprised at how difficult it is to get that information, regardless of whether you're in the fire zone or just trying to figure out whether the fire is near somebody you know. You need the map. And there seems to be very little effort put into that. And also the news media don't seem to be very familiar with the geography, and the information they provide is not very useful. I remember back in the 91 fire, most of the reporting was done from San Francisco. They didn't really know the places and the place names in the East Bay, and they put things on the screen, visuals on the screen showing where the fire was, and they were totally incorrect. They were showing places where the fire was not and not indicating where the fire was. So it was really frustrating. You couldn't get that information to just know where the fire zone was.
I wonder, Barry Pilger, if this pretty much correlates to your own sense, again, of the lack of information on that score that the caller just brought up about maps and where things are going geographically.
The technology is available to us, and you know, the point has been made several times, Michael, that you know the first responders are concerned about saving lives and stopping the fire, and the idea that they would be reporting back to someone who would do an instantly updated Google map with the front of the fire. I suppose that might be in our future. I suppose there might be some satellite imagery, real time, that could be provided. That takes money. It's hard to imagine. What I can tell you is, in 1991, we were driving home from Tahoe, having gotten a phone call that Sunday morning that our neighborhood was on fire, and we, you know, we were 150 miles away. All we could get was KCBS coming over Donner Summit. My wife was driving. Catherine was driving. I had a map of the Bay Area, an old AAA map, and I would start shading out sections that they said had burned. Tunnel Road, homes on Tunnel Road, homes on Hiller Drive, homes on Westmoreland. And what was left by the time we got to the Bay Area was our neighborhood didn't have anything shaded. So we said to ourselves, okay, either we're in an island that survived, or it was so bad no one could get in there and give a report. And of course, it turned out to be the latter.
Yeah.
That was how we kept track of it, and it was reports on KCBS that essentially informed us. We're not much beyond that in terms of technology. Yes, I've been on the CAL FIRE website, and it's sort of updated occasionally, but it's not really, really, really very helpful. One of the things that I might offer is if you know that there's a fire, say, within reach that might potentially be threatening your neighborhood, call your local fire department's non-emergency number and say, what reported fires do you have in the city of Oakland, in the city of Berkeley?
That's good advice.
And a number of neighbors have done that recently and then posted it on our neighborhood listserv saying, you know, I smell smoke, I just call Oakland Fire non-emergency, and they said, no, they're only fighting a structure fire in East Oakland. Boom. There you go. That was real-time information.
All right. And I'm going to go next to Santa Rosa. And Rose, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm from Santa Rosa. I was evacuated from the Larkfield area on Sunday night. And the best information I've been getting, aside from the text from the sheriff, is from the radio station at 102.7 in Sonoma County. They're broadcasting 24 hours a day. They're taking calls from local people who have eyewitness accounts of things or who are offering help. And they're also having local officials on, public information officer and so on, to give really up-to-date information. And that's a great source of information. Also, the Nextdoor social network for each neighborhood has been really, really great. Neighbors are able to, you know, talk about what they know and get information on specific streets, specific blocks. So I just wanted to share that for people who are in Sonoma County and looking for information.
Yeah, I appreciate your sharing that information, Rose, and thank you for it. And I said earlier that one of our listeners, Rick, talked about texting zip codes. That's the NXI program. And NXI actually does keep up to date relevant information from local public safety departments and schools, NIXL, that's NIXLE. And again, remind you that there are tips on our website, GoBag, up at our website, kqed.org/forum, what to do in terms of preparing for a go bag, and let me go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Sid in Los Gatos. Sid, you're on the air.
Hey, just wondering if there exist any social media apps, like, you know, how we use Waze to communicate around traffic, and it's, you know, to a large extent unsolicited or, you know, maybe solicited information, but it's advertised, you know, by users for users. Is there such a community that exists for emergencies? And if not, can one be created by social, by local or state or federal government?
Well, some of those apps are pretty up to date. I don't know, Kevin Van Leer, you want to opine on that?
The only thing I can really think of is understanding where road closures are. I mean, again, that would be a maps type application, but I'm not familiar of anything specific to nationwide disasters or even, you know, statewide or local disasters.
There should be a system, though. I mean,
there should be a system.
You can use an app sometime and there's construction going on and you have to go and it's not in the app,
right.
And so it goes. So.
I mean, right now we have the text alerts depending on how they are in different communities, but as far as a map-type application, I'm not familiar with one.
Let me read a comment from George who says, we ask our local fire department to come out annually to assess fire vulnerabilities. They helpfully recommend specific remediation steps such as cutting back brush, trimming branches, et cetera. And certainly, Barry Pilger, after the Oakland fire, I think you said they got religion up there on that, huh?
Yeah, we're getting better at it. We as community activists have to continue to keep pressure on City Hall to get that effort staffed and that sort of thing. But yeah, for a long time, there is a designated staff within the Fire Prevention Bureau that will respond to a request to, would you come out and evaluate my house and make sure I'm compliant? It takes a little while for them to come out again because that whole unit's been so short-staffed. But it is a service that's available, and once you get their attention and they come out, they're very helpful, and they'll say, well, this isn't code, but you might want to consider this and this and this, and it's very helpful. The City of Oakland's also gotten much better about, and again, this is due to pressure from organizations like ours, has gotten much better at the annual inspections and finding people who don't meet the guidelines within 30 days and that sort of a thing. So, but yeah, those resources are in fact available generally in most jurisdictions.
Kevin, you want to add something here? Kevin,
yeah, just quickly, the top 10 list that I was referring to earlier as far as being able to protect your property from wildfire, so that's available through the Institute for Business and Home Safety. So that's disastersafety.org. And they have lists for many different perils, wildfire, earthquakes, et cetera. The top 10 list of things that you can do around your home, whether that's defensible space, building materials, to help really protect your home in preparedness for a potential disaster.
Well, I thank you both. Kevin Van Leer, again, is wildfire product manager with RMS, a risk management company, and Barry Pilger is chair of the North Hills Community Association. We also spoke with Lisa Ann St. Denis, a research scientist who specializes in social media, with Paul Rogers earlier, our own managing editor of science here, and with Sarah Wright, reporter for KZYZ. When we return, we're going to continue talking about the fires and what's going on in the wake of the fires. We're going to talk about expected devastating economic impact of this fire, and how about rebuilding, what to do in the wake of all the destruction of thousands of buildings and homes, and what to do with, the economies up there, especially the wine economy, the pot economy, and the tourist economy. That's all up ahead. Stay tuned. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.